Hi there, welcome to Left Hand Path, the podcast. We got a bit of news. We've hit our 1,000 viewer count. So congratulations to Mark, Serena, myself, and all yous that have tuned in to watch. Thank you very much.
And Alex, may he rest in peace.
Alex, may he rest in peace. He's alive.
Tuned in to watch.
Yeah, I did think that.
You can watch the...
The image.
Uncut version.
Yep. Yeah. You can watch with your ears. Some could say watching is the new listening.
Oh, do they? Mm-hmm. I haven't heard that one before.
Yeah, you're not properly listening to the podcast unless you're staring at the thumbnail image.
Exactly.
The entire time.
Exactly.
That's true.
So, anyway, who we have here today? We have Mark.
Hey, guys.
We have Serena.
Hello.
We have myself, Max. What's happening?
The topic of our podcast today is...
Oh, it's a bit of an unsolved mystery. We're doing the Sodder Children.
The what?
Sodder. S-O-D-D-E-R.
Mm-hmm. I like it. Do you know anything about it, Mark?
No.
No, I don't know anything about it.
No.
So we're going to... Oh, you want to have a guess?
Yeah, okay. Sodder, I bet it's just the name of a place.
Okay.
And I'm going to guess Sodder, maybe somewhere in Europe. And children. So I reckon there's a whole bunch of children who mysteriously went missing while camping. That's got to be my guess.
Oof. What year?
Late 1900s.
Okay.
I reckon it's going to be a recent thing, because otherwise, like, kids going missing during camping is just, like, not that big of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
They're just like, oh,
not
you know,
a big deal.
A bear got him or something. But if they go missing these days, that's a big deal.
That's true. Okay. All right.
What's your guess, Max?
Sorry, I'm thinking America.
America?
I'm thinking
okay.
America.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, yeah, about maybe like 19-some. And yeah, kids...
Just a decade at least.
Yeah, 19-some. 1920. I'm going to say in a town, and kids just show up dead.
Mm.
Not even from that town.
Who keeps dumping these dead children here?
Well, you're both pretty wrong.
I thought I was... Yeah.
All right,
okay. Nobody goes camping.
Oh.
Fuck.
But is it in a town?
It is in America, so you were right on that instance.
Was it in the 1900s?
1945.
Oh.
Okay.
There you go.
We were close.
Post-war America.
So, as it's the festive season and our last episode of the year, thought it was only fitting that we wrap things up with an unsolved mystery that took place on Christmas Eve.
Oh, we didn't.
We
themed. Damn it.
Fuck. That makes a lot of sense.
That does make a lot of sense. Fuck. Oh, yeah. Merry Christmas, everyone.
Yep. Hope you all got some nice presents.
When you're listening to this, it'll probably be January. I think it'll come out.
Yeah. Hope you had a good Christmas. Good Hanukkah.
Yeah.
Good New Year's.
Good New Year's. Yeah.
Just saying, if you guys got good presents, we appreciate good presents too. Either presents in the comment section or a little bit of a buy me a coffee.
Please donate. The lights keep flickering now.
So, this is a story that's always intrigued me, and it's probably the one that I would choose if I could pick an unsolved mystery to finally be solved.
Mm.
You would solve?
Like, if someone said to you, like, we can choose any unsolved mystery to be solved, which one would you choose? I'd probably choose this one.
You would take to participate in the solving of the case?
Oh, yeah, I don't know how good I would be. So, sources for today's episode include Wikipedia, so also please donate to them if you can. SmithsonianMag.com, AllThat'sInteresting.com, and NPR.com. So this story takes place on December 24th, 1945, in Fayetteville, West Virginia, in the United States.
It's a lot of stories set in West Virginia.
So it's all those places. It's like a Bermuda Triangle.
Mm.
I think it's because all the nuclear missiles there.
Yeah.
It's leaking into the ground and the drinking water.
Ooh.
So, the Sodder family consisted of the father, George Sodder, his wife, Jenny, and their 10 children. They fucking...
Jesus Christ, get off the woman!
There was nothing to watch on TV back
then. That's true.
10 children by the time they're 24.
Okay, so the children's names and ages are as follows.
Oh, God.
Sylvia, age 2. Betty, age 5, Jenny, age 8, Lewis, age 9, Martha, age 12, Maurice, age 14, George Jr., who's 16, John, who was 23, and Marion and Joe. And I couldn't find ages for the last two kids at the time of the incident.
So they were fucking over a course of about 24 years.
Yeah.
More, maybe. Yeah. 25 years.
And there was like a weird, it was like every year, then it was 2 years, and then all of a sudden it was like, what was it, 16, then 23? Then there was just a big fucking gap.
Mm.
And then just smashed those kids out.
They're like, well, we had one, that was pretty fun. Now two, now three.
I mean, yeah, roughly it was like two or so years between each kid. Two or three, I guess. Because I don't know how old Marion and Joe were, so.
Well, it was 19, so it was after the war.
Mm.
So, yeah. You know, what else are you going to do? You just survived the war.
Yeah, so, oh, no, no, it happened in 1945, so it'd been fucking all through the war.
Yeah, so the war had only just ended, like, John was still alive. Oh, no, because
there was a gap between the 23 son and the 16 year son, that was him at war, and he just came back and just went...
No, because they would have had them first, so that would have
been... Yeah, the first few kids.
The husband wasn't...
That would have been in, like, 1920.
Oh, yeah, yeah, fuck.
So, yeah, at the time, Joe was still away at war. And as the war had recently ended, the family were expecting him to return home soon, and they were excitedly waiting his homecoming.
Oh, I jumped the gun.
He's like, how the fuck do you have all these kids? I've been away fighting.
You should be... She's like... So, but honey, when did you know? Learn how to count to 10. You don't count to 5 before you left. The things you learn in the army, sweetheart.
So George Soda was originally born as Giorgio Sodu in Tula Sardina in Italy in 1895. So the age of 13, he immigrated to America with his older brother. For some reason, it seems he went back to Italy after he and George had cleared customs. And he never would speak of why he had left his family behind at such a young age. So he changed his name to the Americanized version, and he went by that for the rest of his life. He eventually found work in Pennsylvania, working on the railroads, carrying water and supplies to the other workers. So keep in mind, he's still a child at this time.
Mm-hmm.
So after a few years passed, he became a driver in Smithers, West Virginia. And from there, he worked up to starting his own trucking company. He would haul dirt and coal from construction sites and mines. So eventually George would meet Jenny. She was also an Italian immigrant who had moved to the States as a child. The two hit it off, and they would eventually get married and move to live 2 miles north of Fayetteville, a town known for having a large percentage of Italian immigrants. So in 1923, they had their first child, Joe, and George continued to expand his business. The family soon became one of the most respected middle-class families in the town. However, George did have some very strong opinions about his opposition to the Italian dictator, Benito Mussolini. So this sometimes led to him getting into arguments with his neighbours.
That Mussolini guy is pretty bad.
Bad news.
Hey, what the fuck are you talking about, man?
He's going to make us great again.
He's all pally-pally with that Hitler fella. You know, he's a good guy.
Do you know Hitler used to be an artist? An artist! What a visionary!
Like Leonardo and Michelangelo, you know? You saying them bad guys?
They were turtles.
You say them bad lizards? How dare you speak bad about Mussolini and turtles?
You're the turtles out of this.
Hey, you're the one calling him a reptile.
You leave my wife out of this.
So, all that said, that takes us back to Christmas Eve of 1945. The eldest daughter, Marion, had returned from working at her job at the local dime store. And she surprised her younger sisters, Martha, Jenny, and Betty, with toys that she'd brought home from her job as gifts.
Oh, that's nice.
So the children were overjoyed, and they begged their mother to let them stay up past their bedtime so they could play with their new toys. So the mother, of course, agreed. It was Christmas Eve, after all. So, however, she said that the two boys that were still awake, Maurice and Lewis, so they had to remember to bring the cows in and feed the chickens before they turned in for the night. So it was around 10 p.m. at this point, and George John and George Jr. had already gone to bed. So after this, Jenny took the baby Sylvia upstairs so they could both go to sleep. However, Jenny was woken up at 12:30 a.m. by the sound of the telephone ringing. She went downstairs to answer the call. When she picked up, she did not recognise the voice of the woman that answered. The strange woman asked to speak to a person whose name Jenny didn't know. She could also hear laughing and the clinking of glasses in the background, as though the woman was calling from a Christmas party. So Jenny told the woman that she had the wrong number. The strange woman then laughed in a weird way and hung up.
So Max, what did her laugh sound like?
Psych, that's the wrong number!
Who was it, darling? I don't know, but they were asking for psych. Do you know psych?
Wrong number.
So thinking nothing of it, Jenny returned to bed. On her way back to the bedroom, she noticed that the curtains were still open and that the lights were still on in the living room. She assumed that the children had forgotten to close them and to turn off the lights, like they usually did, before they went to sleep in that attic bedroom. At 1 a.m, Jenny was again woken by a loud banging noise that sounded like something hitting the roof at the family's home.
Oh, Santa.
She then heard it roll as though it was a ball that had been thrown at the roof. Hearing no further noises, she drifted back to sleep. But half an hour later, Jenny woke again, this time disturbed by the thick smell of smoke. So jumping out of the bed, she realised that the room George used as an office was ablaze.
Oh, sure.
So the family quickly scrambled to get all of their children out of the house. Marion, Sylvia, John and George Jr. were able to make it out of the house, but the other slaughtered children were still trapped upstairs in the attic room.
Ooh.
They called desperately up to the children, but as the staircase was already ablaze, they were unable to go up to them, and they were unable to do anything but yell out, to which they received no response. So they raced to the phone to call the police, but the phone line was dead. Something that struck Jenny as odd, as she had only answered the phone an hour or so prior. Marion then ran to a neighbour's house to use their phone, but she was unable to get through to the operator. A passing motorist had also seen the flames from the burning house and had raced to a local tavern to call the fire department, but he too was unable to get through to an operator. So eventually someone was able to get through to the fire department, but they were critically understaffed as many of the firefighters were still away at war. Things were further delayed as the fire chief, F.J. Morris, was unable to drive the fire truck and had to wait until someone could drive it could be tracked down.
The fire chief could not drive the fire truck.
Yeah, I thought that stuck out as a bit weird for me. Mm.
The guy who's the chief of fire cannot drive the truck of fire.
Maybe he was absolutely munted.
I mean, it was Christmas Eve.
Yeah, I'll take that on. Yeah, alright. Keep that in consideration.
So, George owned a ladder that he used for work and he ran to retrieve it, intending to climb up to the attic window from the outside of the house. However, when he went to grab the ladder, it was not in its usual resting place, and it was nowhere to be found. So the ladder was later discovered, thrown in a ditch some distance away. George then had the idea of backing up one of his trucks against the house and using that to climb up to the attic window. As he put the keys in the ignition, neither one of his trucks would start.
Uh-huh.
Despite the fact that they had both been working perfectly the day before. George attempted to climb up the wall and break a window, but he cut his arm terribly in the process. Feeling beyond hopeless, the six members of the Sodder household had no choice but to stand outside and watch as their family home burnt to the ground, all of them certain that the five children in the attic had perished in the flames. So eventually firefighters did arrive on the scene, but at this stage there was little they could do. I did read somewhere that it was apparently like 7 hours later that the firefighters turned up.
At that point, you just go home.
Yeah, no.
They're like, damn, I can't believe it's still burning.
I think it had already burned out by this stage.
Damn, we did a good job.
Look, boys, the fire's out.
It got too scared and ran away. 7 hours.
That's pretty bad.
That's really bad. Okay, and all the phone lines weren't working.
And the ladder was missing.
And the earth shell on the roof.
And there's a strange phone call.
Hear that perhaps the phone lines weren't, like, the one in the Sodder house was down, but the reason other people couldn't get through to the operator was maybe because it was Christmas Eve and nobody was, like,
yeah, tending to it on. Yeah.
Mm. It does seem very strange, though. I wonder if he's like made any enemies in becoming like the man about town.
And going against, talking against Mussolini. But I can't remember. I don't really know much about Mussolini. I know he was like, I know he was liked, but then.
Some people liked him.
Yeah, and then near the end of the war, I mean, not a lot of people liked him, because at the end of the war, they fucking tied his ass to horses and split him in half.
They, I know they tied him up to, like, a gas station and, like, pinata'd him, basically.
And then got four horses to rip his limbs off.
Lovely.
So I think this takes place shortly after Mussolini was executed.
Maybe, yeah. Something. So, no, he died around, first, and then Hitler died. No, I don't, can't remember how long after.
So yeah, when the police arrived, they searched through the ashes. Sorry, the firefighters arrived. They searched through the ashes in the basement. By 10 a.m., Chief Morris informed the family that they hadn't discovered any bones, which one would normally expect had there been children in the house as it burned. Regardless, Morris believed that the fire had burned hot enough that it had destroyed the bones completely.
How hard does it need to get, Mark, to
burn bones? Why'd you ask this? Because I actually Googled it, so I knew somebody would ask.
Yeah, because didn't we also talk about this in our very
we did.
Famous
H.H. Holmes?
H.H. Holmes.
So,
I think, like, 1,000 Fahrenheit, you need to, like, properly cremate something.
Celsius.
Oh, Celsius.
So, temperatures of 1,100 degrees Celsius and above are needed for complete bone breakdown. Standard house fires reach temperatures of up to 815 degrees Celsius, according to firefighterinsider.com.
And these are old houses.
Yeah.
So.
So I was wondering that too, whether there'd be more or less burnable things.
Because
I feel like nowadays we'd have a lot of synthetic materials and stuff that would just catch.
It's more like the temperature of combustion of the material. Like,
so.
For a lot of human history, they couldn't make steel because they couldn't get the fires hot enough.
Mm-hmm.
Just because when wood burns, they're not able to retain enough of the heat, and it doesn't generate enough heat for them to actually be able to get the temperatures up that high and sustain it up that high.
Then industry came along.
Yeah. So, like, once they got better at ceramics and could build a forge that didn't shit itself.
Mm. Yeah. A little history lesson there for you guys.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't think that's strange. Why would they? Oh, you know what? I guess we'll find out a little bit more. That's the mystery. I'm assuming is what happened to these fucking kids.
So Chief Morris told the Sauter family to leave the site of the house fire untouched, so that the state fire marshal's office could come out and conduct a proper search of the property, and conduct a more thorough investigation. However, George and Jenny couldn't bear to look at the scene of the tragedy, and after 4 days had passed, George had the site covered over by 5 feet of dirt with the intention of turning the site into a memorial garden dedicated to the lost children. So the family would later rebuild a new house on a different location of their property. So an inquest was held by the local coroner the next day, and they decided that the fire had been caused by faulty wiring. So on December 30th, death certificates for the 5 Sauter children were issued. So the Sauter family attempted to move forwards with their lives, but as they did, they were presented with far more questions than answers, and they began to question all of the official findings surrounding the fire.
Yeah, for starters, faulty wiring. What the fuck makes them think that?
Yeah.
That just sounds like a bullshit reason. Like, they got there 7 hours after the fire started. There's basically nothing left. Just the basement.
Mm.
It's like, what wires are you going to say is faulty?
That's a good point.
So, they questioned how the fire was supposedly caused by an electrical fault,
lights
had remained on during the early stages of the fire. Jenny credited the lights being on as to how the family was able to see to escape the fire as easily as they had since it was dark out, and that Christmas lights had even still been on. So, the more they began to look into things, the more suspicious things appeared. A telephone repairman that came out to repair the telephone line also reported to the Sauters that the line hadn't been destroyed by the fire as they had originally suspected, but it appeared to have been deliberately cut. So neighbours had reported a man that they had seen stealing a block and tackle from the Sauter's property around the time of the fire. The man was later caught and arrested. He admitted to climbing up and cutting the power line, as he believed it to be, sorry, the phone line, as he believed it to be the power line. However, there is no record that exists as to why the man was attempting to cut that power line.
Yeah.
Or whilst he was stealing the block and tackle.
Did you cut their phone line? No, I was trying to cut their power line instead. Well, he's innocent. Let him go.
It's Christmas.
I feel like, I wonder how much of that went into it, that they just couldn't be fucked doing good investigative work.
No, because it's Christmas. And here's the next part, is like, I don't know if the suspicion is like, oh, the family did it themselves, but it's like, the guy got there 7 hours. It's like...
I'd love to know the ethnicity of the police and fire department, because like, Americans fucking hated immigrants, still do. And it's like, back in the day, you know, you had all your Poles, your Italians, all these other people there.
Irish and all that, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, but it did say that the neighbourhood they moved into was primarily Italian immigrants.
Yeah, but would the police department be?
Don't know.
Because it could just be they're like, some fucking Italians, you know, their house burnt down and they're, you know, getting all upset about it or whatever. Just put something down on the report and leave it.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
So this man denied having anything to do with the fire. The Sotter family later suspected the man had also taken the ladder that they later found at the bottom of an embankment 23 metres away. They also began to believe that the man had tampered with George's trucks on the night of the fire, causing them not to start. Though it has also been suggested that the trucks may have had difficulty getting started due to the cold weather, or the engines may have flooded in George's rush to get them started.
That's a lot of effort just to steal a block of tackle, you know?
Yeah, you know, cut it. Try and cut someone's power supply.
Yeah.
Actually cutting their comms. Like, car's not working. The ladder's gone missing as well.
It's like, that's so much effort to get such a little reward.
So Jenny was also becoming convinced that if her children had been in the house fire, then some evidence of their bones would have remained. So many still recognisable household appliances had been found in the rubble, as well as fragments of the tin roof. They also said something at the time as well, that had so many kids, you know, burnt alive, they would have heard some screaming, or you would have been able to smell the burning flesh.
Well, apparently it burned so hot it just incinerated them.
So Jenny also read a newspaper article about a similar house fire that had occurred. So in this story, a family of seven had perished in the fire, and the skeletal remains of all the victims had been discovered. So she began to do a little research herself. Collecting animal bones that had been left over from dinners, she burned them to see if they would be completely destroyed by the fire. They were not. She even contacted an employee at a local crematorium. They told her that human bone fragments remain even after the bodies were burned at 1,090 degrees Celsius for 2 hours. So this was far longer and hotter than the house fire had been in full force. So the strange evidence around the house fire continued to mount, and by 1946, the Sotter family became convinced that the fire had been lit with sinister intentions, and that their children were not in the house at the time the fire occurred, but might indeed be alive somewhere else.
Kidnapping, fire to hide their evidence, keep cops, police and fire brigades distracted.
Yeah.
To get away. That would explain the phone lines.
Why would they kidnap kids though?
There's a lot of fucking reasons.
Yeah. I suppose so.
None pleasant.
So a bus driver that was passing through Fayetteville on Christmas Eve came forwards. He claimed to have seen people throwing what he described as balls of fire at the house. So a few months after this, when the snow had melted, Sylvie had been playing outside near the side of the old house, and she discovered a hard green rubber ball-like object in a nearby bush. So it was later identified to be a type of grenade known as a pineapple bomb. So this tied in with Jenny's claims that she'd heard a loud bang and an object bouncing on the roof on the night of the fire.
These fuckers are throwing fucking shrapnel-like grenades at these people's fucking houses.
The family had also claimed that the fire had been started in the roof.
Huh.
Interestingly, before the night of the fire, George had also been threatened on two instances by people that his house would burn down.
Oh, come on.
So the first was a life insurance salesman that had visited the Slaughter home to try and sell George life insurance. So when George declined, the man became irate. He screamed at him, "Your goddamn house is going to go up in smoke, and your children are going to be destroyed. You're going to pay for all the dirty remarks that you've been making about Mussolini."
That's one hell of a sales pitch.
Jeez, bro, I'm still not buying it. Like, very convincing.
Then you'll burn in the fires of hell, and you'll wish you had the insurance then.
So it was later revealed that this same man served on the coroner's jury that had decided the fire was an accident, attributing it to the faulty
electrics. For fuck's sake, there is too many pieces just sliding into place to make this shit seem so fucking clear as day.
Mm.
So another instance of threatening behaviour was when a man visited the house asking for work. So George regretfully told him that he had no work to offer. But instead of leaving, the strange man walked around to the back of the house, and George followed him to keep an eye on him. So the man was studying a pair of fuse boxes and told George they would cause a fire someday. George was confused by this statement, as he had an electric stove installed recently, and the electricity company had come out and checked out the wiring and declared that it was all safe. Another suspicious thing to note was that in the weeks prior to Christmas, the older sort of boys had told their parents that they had seen a strange car parked along the main highway in town.
Hmm.
The occupants looked as though they were watching the younger sort of children as they walked home from school. So at the time, the sort of parents brushed things off. But after the events of the fire, they began to suspect that it was indeed something more sinister. The family also suspected that the strange call that Jenny received on Christmas night was someone ringing up to check that the Slaughter family was home before they set the house on fire.
Mm.
However, investigators were eventually able to track down the woman that had made the call, and it was confirmed to have been a legitimate wrong number. So other witnesses later came forward, and they made claims that on the night of the fire, they had seen the Slaughter children peering out of a passing car as the fire burned. Another woman that worked at a rest stop located between Fayetteville and Charleston claimed that she had served them breakfast the next morning, and also noted that there was a car with Florida license plates parked outside the diner.
Hmm.
These sightings, however, were never substantiated. So the Slaughter family then hired a private investigator named C.C. Tinsley to look into the case. So it was Tinsley that had learned that the man that had threatened George Slaughter for making anti-Mussolini comments had been on the coroner's jury. Tinsley also uncovered rumours that when searching the house, Fire Chief Morris had found a human heart.
What?
Instead of declaring the finding, he had instead placed it into a metal box and secretly returned to the site to bury it. Supposedly Morris had told this to a local minister during a confession. The minister also confirmed the story to George Slaughter. George then confronted Morris, who agreed to show him where the box was buried, and it was dug up. George took the box and its contents to a local funeral director that told the men that the human heart that was inside the box was in fact a beef liver. So a beef liver that had never even been exposed to fire. So there was no way that the liver was ever at the site of the fire when it occurred.
Why the fuck would he bury a beef liver in?
So it was believed that Morris had placed the liver there and spread the rumours of the discovered human heart in the hopes that the Slaughter family would believe it was the heart of one of their missing children, thus confirming they had died in the fire, and they would stop looking.
That is some real bad logic.
That is, out of everything that would survive, the heart would survive. And a fire that melted bones.
Can you imagine it? He's like, he's sitting there with a glass of whiskey, just sipping it, thinking about how to distract his family. And he's like, yeah, everything around the heart burned away, except for the heart.
Because the ribs would protect the heart.
And they turned to ashes, they would have coated it, and ashes can't burn, so the heart was fine.
Yeah.
Fuck, I'm smart.
God, that's why I'm the chief of fire.
Can someone else pull the fire truck around for me, thanks.
Yeah, and also, why is he getting so invested in this?
Because he's the fire chief, so I think back then they kind of had to solve the mystery as well, sort of thing.
No, he's the chief, though. It's the marshal that does that.
Apparently they're understaffed.
I don't know, back then it might have been different.
Apparently, very understaffed. I don't know where they found this fucking guy. Was it the dude that he did not hire? He went to the fire fucking... This is all looking really sus. Because remember, people were very spiteful back in the day.
Still are.
I mean, yeah, but it's just people could get away with more because there was less surveillance. So, man, there's a lot going on here.
Yeah. Yeah, it sort of sounds like the town's out to get George and his family.
But they're so well respected.
It almost sounds like people might have been paid off, sort of thing. Yeah. I don't know.
For speaking against Mussolini in another country, in the middle of Pennsylvania, in a small Italian community.
West Virginia,
baby. Oh, sorry, West Virginia. Where the war's nearly ending.
Has ended.
If someone was trash-talking Mussolini and you were already upset about that, and then Mussolini was, like, horribly murdered and you were sad about that, you might direct that rage elsewhere.
Yeah, especially if he was like, I fucking told you so. He got what he had coming to him. Absolute dirty dog. I hope he's burning in hell right now. You could just see some guy who's been sitting there listening to it for years, just like, fuck it, that's it. If Mussolini's gonna burn, so can this guy.
I hope these guys that ever did this, I hope someone's told them, like, so you guys orchestrate this crazy hit on this family.
Mm.
Everything went completely right for you. Why are you in America, not in Italy, helping out Mussolini? He really could have used your guys' help. Oh, I bet you they were used to be a part of Mussolini's crew. And then they fled.
Maybe.
I don't know if the timeline would sort of match up. So George was relentless in his pursuit for his missing children. So the lack of help from the authorities didn't stop George from tracking down every last lead himself. He would scour newspapers looking at pictures of young ballet dancers, and he would drive up to the ballet schools himself to confirm the identity of the girls and rule out the possibility that were his missing daughter.
What? Ballet school?
I think he just saw pictures in the paper and he thought, that kind of looks like my daughter. I'm going to drive up and make sure it's not her.
Okay. Fair enough.
So, George Sauter also got into contact with the FBI directly, and he communicated with the then FBI director, J. Edgar Hoover, telling him that he believed a kidnapping had occurred. So Hoover wrote back a letter to him stating, although I would like to be of service, the matter unrelated appears to be of a local character and does not come within the investigative jurisdiction of this bureau. If the local authorities request the bureau's assistance, then he would of course direct agents to assist. However, the Fayetteville police and fire departments refused the offer. I think it's real fucking weird as well.
Why?
Because, J. Edgar Hoover was like, you know, the FBI guy can't really get involved unless, like, the local police and firefighting department says it's okay.
Mm.
And then the police and the firefighting department were like, no, FBI can't get involved.
Oh, it's because they hate each other. Remember that time?
I don't know, it's too wild.
Yeah. Mm.
Like, if you're not invested in solving the case, surely you think someone else can.
Yeah, but that's all the thing. Someone else, like, basically, like, someone from another department who's technically kind of your boss coming in and being like, you guys are all fucking morons.
Mm. Yeah, but if you don't want to solve it, may as well let someone else. I don't get that.
Yeah, but they don't want to solve it. They don't want it to get solved.
Yeah, that's true.
And they don't want to, because then if the FBI goes and gets in there and then they solve it, it makes them look fucking stupid.
Yeah, and they're like, it's already closed. It was an electrical fire.
Yeah, done.
Just let him rest, George.
So in August of 1949, it was decided to excavate the grounds of where the Sauter house once stood. So a pathologist from DC named Oscar Hunter came out to assist. So a thorough search was carried out, and they found several items that had survived the fire, such as some coins and the children's dictionary. Several bone fragments were also discovered, including what appeared to be a human vertebrae. So it was later determined that the human lumbar vertebrae that they found all belonged to the same individual. However, when the bones were sent to a specialist named Marshall T. Newman, who worked at the Smithsonian Institute, it was pointed out that as the transverse recesses were fused at the age of the individual, the bones belong to should be around 16 or 17 years old. The specialist also noted in his findings that the maximum age of the person the bones belonged to was 22, as the centra was still unfused and it normally fuses at 23 years old. So it seemed very unlikely that the bones discovered belonged to any of the missing Sota children, as the oldest boy, Maurice, had only been 14 at the time of the fire.
Huh.
So it was also determined that the bones showed no signs of being exposed to fire, casting further doubt that the bones belonged to the Sota children. It was theorised that perhaps the bones had come from the dirt that George Sota had used to cover up the site of the house fire. So, with no confirmation of where the dirt came from and whose bones were in it.
I just dug up some of the fucking...
Yeah, it was just... it's like another mystery, like, whose bones are these now?
Oh, fuck!
So the bones were supposedly returned to George in September
1949. It's under fucking
one. The whereabouts of them is unknown.
Where did you get these from? Oh, that burial ground? You moved their tombstones, but you didn't move the graves!
Don't confuse the soil yard with the cemetery.
Oof, that's funny. This mystery is getting crazier.
Yeah.
I mean, Scooby-Doo and the gang have figured this one out.
But how long did bones last for?
Long
quite
time.
A while, right?
Yeah, very long time.
Yeah, so it could have been like, you know, just bits of bone left over from something ages ago.
No, it was that they weren't exposed to the fire.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
So the bones would have been after the fire because that's what they were covered over.
Yeah, or before the fire.
I don't think it was deep
enough. And they were just in the soil.
Because they only dug down like 5 feet, I think.
So. No, but from the soil they found.
Yeah, because he covered the side of the old house with soil from somewhere. And we're just saying that the bones could be in that soil.
Could have been a dude. Could have been an old Civil
War
battlefield.
That's not what was suggested,
yeah.
But...
Could have been a dude that just, you know, died, you know, a pilgrim guy or a Native American.
Possibly. Or Charlie went camping and ran into a bear.
The possibility. The possibilities are endless. Case closed.
So the Sota family continued to take matters into their own hands. They had flyers printed with the pictures of the missing children on them. They would hand out around town, advertising a $5,000 reward for information. So they would settle the case so that they would settle the case for the fate of even one of the children. The reward money was later doubled to $10,000, which is the equivalent of over $300,000 today.
Jeez.
This guy was making bank.
I don't know they were making bank, but they're just like desperate.
Mm.
Still, $10,000.
He's like, man, look at all these school fees I don't have to pay.
For my kids.
So in 1952, the Sota family also erected a large billboard on their property that had the same information and images that were printed on the flyers. So the sign would occasionally be painted with new messages. But just to give you an idea of one version of the billboard read. On Christmas Eve, 1945, our home was set afire, and five of our children, ages 5 through 14, kidnapped. Officials blamed defective wiring, although lights were still burning after the fire started. The official report stated that the children died in the fire. However, no bones were found in the residue, and there was no smell of burning flesh after the fire. What was the motive of the law officers involved? What did they have to gain by making us suffer all these years of injustice? Why did they lie and force us to accept those lies? So the attention drawn by the billboard brought with it a slew of new rumours and supposed sightings of the missing children. So a woman that worked in a Charleston hotel came forward and told the Sotas that around a week after the fire, she had seen the children come into the hotel with two men and two women that appeared to be Italian. She claimed that she attempted to make conversation with the children, but one of the men became hostile towards her and froze her out of the conversation as they continued to speak in Italian. Supposedly, they all checked out of the hotel by the next morning. So this supposed sighting was not thought of as particularly credible, as the woman only came forward after came forward 5 years after she had first seen the photos of the missing children. So other rumours swelled that relatives of Jenny Sota had taken the children and they were all living up in Florida. So another claimed that Martha Sota was being held in a convent in St. Louis, Missouri. Other rumors suggested that the children had been taken back to Italy by the mafia.
Mm-hmm. But why? Maybe it was like they set the fire and then they saw the kids and they're like, fuck, let's get the kids out.
And well, then, I think personally the kids weren't in the house because remember she was saying, like the mom said before they went to bed, like you got to remember to like, you know, feed the chicken and like let the cows out or whatever.
Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, they probably got
now. So outside. The kids probably went outside and then whoever was had been watching them from a car was like, now's our chance.
Mm.
Yeah, or maybe it's like the kids came out and they just went, oh shit, that's not part of the plan. Grab them so they can't tell anyone. And then once they had them, they're like, fuck, now we've taken the kids. What are we going to do? Like, if we let them go, they know it's deliberate sabotage. We're deliberately burning the house. Whatever, let's just take them with us.
Yeah.
And also because, like, the curtains weren't drawn and the lights weren't turned off like the kids always did before they went to bed.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah, they were taken. Probably, yeah, they're headed off somewhere. I don't think they were probably killed. Maybe the older ones were killed. Maybe the younger ones weren't.
Don't know.
So another tip they received came from Texas. A woman had written that a man she knew had revealed that he was Lewis after having too much to drink one night, that he and his brother Maurice were living in Houston. However, when the man was tracked down, he denied ever claiming that he was Lewis Sotter. George travelled all over the country, following up on these leads, determined to uncover the truth of the missing children. The most credible bit of evidence the family received was a letter that had been sent to them from Central City, Kentucky, that featured no return address. So the letter contained a photograph of a man in his 30s that bore a striking resemblance to Lewis. On the back of the photo was written, Lewis Sotter, I love Braveless Frankie, LLIL Boys, A90132, all 35. So the family didn't understand the message on the back. They didn't know anyone by the name of Brother Frankie, and the message seemed like gibberish. I did read, however, somewhere that one theory was that random numbers were coordinates to somewhere in Italy.
Hmm.
So nonetheless, the photo of the man looked like an older Lewis, and it gave them hope. They added an enlarged image of the photograph to their billboard, and they also framed a copy of the picture to hang over their fireplace, truly believing it could be their missing son. So they also hired a private detective to investigate the area in Central City, Kentucky, where the letter had been postmarked from. However, they never heard back from the PI. So it's unknown whether the PI simply dipped after receiving the money in advance, or if something more sinister had occurred. George Sotter continued his search for his missing children right up to his death in 1969. So before his passing, he'd been quoted as saying, time is running out for us, but we only want to know. If they did die in the fire, we want to be convinced. Otherwise, we want to know what happened to them. So after the death of her husband, Jenny Sotter became more and more withdrawn. She mainly stayed inside their family home, constructing new rooms or tending to the memorial garden. She also continued to dress in all black by way of mourning, as she had ever since the night of the fire. When Jenny passed away in 1989, her children took down the billboard. However, they didn't give up their search for their missing siblings. So the youngest Sotter child, Sylvia, actually passed away this year. So up until her death, she'd never given up the search, browsing online forums and searching for answers well into her 70s. So Sylvia's daughter, Jenny Henton, still continues the search today. And that is the sad unsolved mystery of the Sotter children.
Hmm. I can see why you'd pick that one to solve.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Jeez. So what do we think? There was the father who was speaking out against Mussolini.
Mm-hmm.
We seem to agree that the children were kidnapped.
Yes.
The house was burnt down because someone was throwing fucking pineapple grenades at it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, sure.
Yeah, there's just no reason why grenade would be there except for the fact that someone threw it at the house.
Yeah, they sabotaged the cars, the phone line, and the ladder.
Mm.
Which is still suspicious because it's like, so their intention wasn't to kill, it was to destroy the property. Because if you wanted to kill them, you'd
block the doors.
You
put the grenades, you throw them through the windows.
Yeah.
You went through on the roof, so it was to burn the house, but they gave them every chance to get away. But just not call.
Yeah, or get help.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess you'd be like, you know, fuck it, you're losing your entire house.
Yeah, the police thing was probably, I think what you think, I think they just didn't give a shit about telling everyone else.
Yeah. Well, just because it was Christmas Eve and it was Christmas.
Yeah.
Like, this is too much paperwork for over the holidays. Plus, most of the time back then, police work and stuff was pretty half-assed anyway. Yeah.
So, yeah.
We've seen that in previous cases we've discussed.
So it was half-assed work, and I feel a very, very incompetent fire chief.
Yeah.
That I guess at one moment thought, oh, if I show a heart or whatever, it will give them clarity to move on and doing something.
Stop asking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They probably did flee maybe to the Florida, probably Italy. The older boys are probably probably died.
Well, I did see something that said that perhaps the kids were told that their family had died in the fire, so that they wouldn't, you know, question it, I guess.
Mm.
And back then, if you moved to a different state, you kind of like didn't know what was happening because it's not like news was so available.
Probably they were doing the burning and the kids were outside and they're like, oh, get away from there, blah blah blah. Yeah, and then they probably grew up with their captors, Stockholm syndrome.
Yeah,
that's probably it. And then just everyone dies.
I feel like there could be, like, you know, with the DNA research, like, you know, like 23andMe style stuff. I feel like stuff like that could possibly turn up something interesting in the future. Like, if the kids survived and had kids of their own, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But even then, it would just show you, like, your ancestry. It wouldn't show you who you're directly related to unless they get DNA from them. Which
they would have to trace it back and see who the father was. Plus, if they... I don't know if they had any DNA from, like, Jenny or Sylvia or something, they could use mitochondrial DNA, which is the one that comes from the mother.
The FBI probably would have took samples, you know, but they weren't involved, so...
They weren't allowed. To be fair, though, if you were the sort of children that, like, you dedicated your whole lives, like, you've grown up, that you're missing siblings and your parents are obsessed with solving the case, and Sylvia's, like... every day on true crime forums right until she passed away and like promised her daughter, like made her daughter promise to continue searching, you'd be like, personally if it was me, I'd be like, here, save some of my hair, here's a saliva swab in a baggie.
Probably did, but like after X amount of years, it's like, psh, that's it, it's done. Plus, like, also if they took the kids abroad to like Italy or something, like this is after war, so like Europe's rebuilding, so like, new people coming in.
Yeah,
couple of Italian kids. It's so old back then, nobody really cares.
Yeah, they'd be like, oh, we're sons, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, those kids probably grew up with someone else. And, and they're just,
I did wonder if something had happened, like, and this is probably not related at all, if something had happened to George Soder's family back in Italy that involved, like, Mussolini, because the fact that he came across and never talked about what happened and his brother, like, basically dropped him in America and then went back. And then he spoke all his life about his opposition to Mussolini. I was like,
Maybe
part of like a resistance movement or something.
Yeah. Or just he was, you know, that he had like a personal stake why he hated him.
Yeah.
So probably not relevant at all what happened to kids though, but just.
Yeah.
I wondered.
Yeah, it's horrible events.
Yeah. That. It's an interesting mystery. It's a. Shame that it's probably fucked up those, was it five kids or six kids' lives? Yeah, six kids' lives.
Yeah, five kids were stolen, so no, it would have been five that remained.
All 10 kids.
There was 10 kids.
All 10 kids are fucked up.
Yeah
I think everyone in the family is fucked up.
Just hardworking people.
Yeah. So, how's this a Christmas story again?
Happened on Christmas Eve.
Ah, right.
It's Santa Claus.
A Christmas story, but...
When Santa flew in and he said, ha ha ha, yeah, sorry about that, kids.
You're on the naughty list.
Drop my presents.
Christmas, a pineapple bomb.
Well, I think we got a pretty good, what we believe it to be, is the finale.
Probably similar to what everyone else has come to. Like, same conclusion, I mean.
I just, I feel like he must have been so offended to go to such extremes to punish that family home.
Spider-Man.
Yeah, plus people just work themselves up in their own head about things. Like, when you think about things that cause people to murder, it's not, usually it's not something that would really warrant a murder. It's just like small shit, and you, as an outsider, you can shake your head and be like, oh, why the fuck did they do that? Why didn't they just talk it over and get a divorce? Or why didn't he just, you know, move away or
speak to
blah,
someone?
Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true, I guess.
People just like...
people be crazy.
Yeah. Get very worked up.
Yeah, what a note to end the year on.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you all for listening.
Yeah, thanks for sticking with us.
Jinx.
Thanks for sticking with us, guys. Appreciate your support and comments all through the year. So we're looking forward to keeping bringing you new content next year.
Yeah.
Now that we've got most of the house stuff settled, we're going to try and be a bit more regular with our posting.
Yeah, and hopefully do a little bit of work on upgrading our equipment so you can hear our dulcet tones in even higher quality.
We won't, though. We're going to stick with the same gear.
Not until some of you fuckers donate to us.
Now, thank you all for listening. Thank you all for sharing. It's much appreciated. Thanks for telling if you've got any friends, you tell them. For those that have commented, thank you very much. You can find us anywhere, any podcast, any social media. That's where we are.
Move 10 Path, the podcast.
Yeah. Please leave us comments.
Like and subscribe.
All right, peace, guys.
We'll see you next year.
Catch you then.
Happy New Year. You filthy animals.
It's been real.